The information and ideas discussed in this program are intended to be educational and to motivate listeners to take control of their own financial future. Because the subject matter is complex and situations differ widely between individuals, we strongly recommend that you consult qualified professionals before acting on the information discussed in the program.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason Papier, and along with my co-host Peter Johnson, we've got a great show for you this week. But first, if you haven't been to our website yet, please visit www.promoneytalk.com. There you'll be able to ask us a question that we may answer on the air and sign up for our email list. Now, if you've already signed up for our email list and haven't received the confirmation, I owe you a big apology. Apparently, we've had some difficulty with the list server, and I'm going to have to ask you sheepishly to sign up again. I'm really sorry for the inconvenience, but I've been assured everything is fixed and we won't have any further problems. Okay, now back to the fun. 2 weeks ago, we interviewed Ed Slott on how to stretch your IRA into a huge sum for your heirs. If you haven't listened to that show, I urge you to go back and listen. It's very valuable information. After that show, I noted that we would be continuing the theme of passing money to heirs and some of the problems that can arise. Well, in today's show, Peter is going to be talking about just that. This is the first of a two-part series where he'll cover the importance of family communication in the estate planning process. It's extremely important information. In the second segment today, I'll be interviewing Skip Weiss of Brownson, Remus, and Foxworth on what to do if you have a lot of your net worth in a single stock. This is a problem we see in planning primarily because of stock options and grants, but also due to inheritance. Skip discusses the alternatives available and in what scenarios it makes sense to use each of those alternatives. This is a problem I expect many of our listeners are currently facing, so this is likely to be one of the most popular shows. Thank you again for listening to Pro Money Talk, and enjoy the show. Okay, today we're going to talk about another really important topic, actually life-changing, and that topic is the importance of family communication with regard to money. This is a real opportunity to make a difference in your family's welfare for generations to come, not just financially, but in terms of family strength and values. I'll mention a personal interest in how I got involved in this topic during the show. I also want to mention that there is an article about the subject that I wrote for the Journal of Practical Estate Planning in the April and May issue that you'll find a link to in the show notes. The article is called Enhancing Family Communication, Everyone Wins. In today's segment, the first of two parts, I'll talk about why this subject is important. I'll talk about my story, my family's history. I'll talk about some of the benefits of family communication, as well as the big picture. And finally, I'll also talk about how to overcome some of the common barriers to family money communication. Next week, in the final segment, we'll finish up by talking about some tools and techniques that families can use to improve communication and bring them closer together. And we'll share some books and other resources available for those who want to explore this concept further in their own lives. So first of all, why is family communication about money and finance important? I have six main points to make here. The first is that family relationships can be made or broken on the subject of money. Through communication, relationships can be strengthened, and family disputes, jealousies, and suspicions can be allayed. Second reason that family communication about money is important is that we really don't have systems or programs in place in our culture to help people learn about money or the responsibilities that they'll face. Families generally don't talk about money. Financial planners and attorneys often address only the individual that's sitting in the chair across from them, and our education system pays little, if any, attention to this vital area of our lives. Third point is, it takes years to develop understanding skills, and habits that lead to financial success. So starting early is important, ideally in the family. Fourth, without an understanding of financial principles, young people struggle needlessly. It's one of my own personal passions, is that young people who don't know what they're doing with money run into problems and they struggle. No amount of hard work or education guarantees success by itself. Handling money well is also an important part of success. Fifth reason that this is important is that young people are impressionable, and if they're introduced early, they can become motivated to learn more and practice discipline with regard to money. I think it's exciting to see kids get interested in the subject and involved. And finally, leaving substantial amounts of money to young people can be damaging. The example I like to use is giving a kid keys to a Ferrari without driving lessons. Obviously, there's a potential for real trouble. And because money is powerful, kids can also get into trouble when they get money unexpectedly. So talking about it early is important, preparing them for it, and giving them the tools to handle it well. I mentioned at the beginning of today's show that I have a strong personal interest in this subject of family communication around money, and it's based on some, I think, unfortunate circumstances that I grew up with. My great-grandfather was a self-made multimillionaire who began his career selling scrap pieces of plywood off the back of his bicycle when he was a teenager. Gradually, he built up an industry empire that included a shipping company as well as an interstate lumber company, and I believe that he was supplying more than half of the wood used by China and Japan prior to World War II. So he was worth something like $100 million, and I know that he went to great lengths to set up the money so that it would last for generations in the family. But at least in my case, I didn't see any communication about money, any coaching, mentoring, or preparation for it. And like I said before, if you come into money and you're not prepared for it, it can actually create problems in your life. In my own case, there was no incentive to go to work or to go to school or to face any of the difficult issues that we have to get over to grow as an individual. So in a way, money became a burden complicating our lives. It was not the blessing it was intended to be. Overall, although we didn't have a close family, I was aware that different members of the family sort of dabbled at careers and some drifted into drugs and alcohol. In the mid-1980s, all of that came home to roost when my grandfather's second wife left her estate to charity, along with my grandfather's, which totaled about $60 million. And her reasoning for leaving the money to charity instead of to the family was that she didn't like what money was doing to the family. So we not only lost that money, but we had a series of family court battles over what money was left, and that was combined with suspicions and accusations and a lot of acrimony. I have three brothers, actually a brother and two half-brothers, and we haven't talked to or seen each other in 25 years. This is something of a worst-case scenario, but it does illustrate the common occurrence of a phenomenon called shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. It turns out that there are sayings in many different cultures around the world that parallel that, and what it means is that one generation will make a lot of money, but three generations later, the family's lost that money. The family values, the ability to conserve and to use money wisely has been lost along the way. And my eyes were opened when I read a book called Preparing Heirs by Roy Williams and Vic Pracer. which discussed the importance of family communication in preparing children for eventual inheritances. And a light bulb went on in my head, and I said, wow, everything could have been different in my family if we had talked about money and been prepared for it. So that's where my passion comes from, and that's why we're talking about the subject today. There are a number of significant benefits when families communicate about money. They can enjoy a greater sense of satisfaction and harmony within the family, reducing or avoiding conflicts. They can build financial and emotional security, which is enhanced as a result of full family participation and cooperation. In addition, greater participation in the planning process minimizes the risk of wealth dissipation. That, as I said, families that don't know how to handle money don't hang on to it very well. In addition, children may have a greater chance at success, as during the process they have a chance to express their interests, thus building self-esteem and providing the opportunity for support and mentoring. Some kids are interested in developing careers or taking over family business. Others may have charitable interests. And really, if you delve deep enough, it usually turns out that there's some role that each family member can play, some passion, and they can start small. Ultimately, families are happier and have a greater sense of meaning and belonging. There's a concept that's very popular in financial planning circles these days called life planning. And life planning is a pretty broad concept, but basically it's the effort to understand the client's dreams and passions and what they really care about so that the planner can help them address the issues in a way that gets them to what they want out of life. So we consult with clients about money, but it's really the meaning to the individual that's essential. So what I like to do is talk about it in a bigger context instead of the context of the individual. Talk about the context of the family and life planning for the family. So each person's dreams can be addressed. And so the family values can be discussed and perhaps put in such a way that they can be told as stories and carried on from generation to generation. It really puts everything in context, and it helps family members learn how to play as a team, because when you hear the passions and interests of the others, you realize you have to make some compromises about what can be accomplished, but it's a chance to get excited about each other's visions and also to appreciate the founder's work in building the family wealth to begin with. So we're talking about the big picture here, and it's important to have some overriding mission or goals to kind of like a guiding star or a landmark that you can guide the family planning by. Of course, a lot of this, as I said, starts early, and children have a lot to learn when it comes to money. We can recommend an excellent guide to the process of teaching kids about money, a book called Silver Spoon Kids by Eileen and John Gallo, with particular attention paid to wealthy families who wish their children to grow up with balanced and sound money attitudes. Again, links to these books are in the show notes. So all this talk about getting families to communicate money sounds good, and pie in the sky, and everything's sweet and wonderful, but we all know that it's difficult to communicate and that there are often tensions and fears and roadblocks to communication. In fact, a client was just telling me today that his relationship with his mother-in-law ended when he suggested that she do a certain kind of estate planning. So it can be a difficult topic to begin to address, but there's some tools that you can use to get it started. Obviously, one of the barriers or common challenges is just inertia. Culture and tradition generally have us believing that the estate isn't talked about until the will is read in the attorney's office, you know, after the person dies. Of course, by then, it's a little late to to do this family communication. The reason that we're talking about this is to help spread the word that it doesn't have to be that way. And in fact, there may be reasons to do it a different way. Also, attorneys and financial planners, as I mentioned, are paid to serve the person in front of them. And in attorney's case, they're not even supposed to be talking to other family members. They have conflicts of interest. So you need to find specialists if you want professional help in dealing with this. There are some people who are beginning to provide services along these lines, but it's not that common yet. But just by talking about it and thinking about it, we could probably at least scratch the surface and break the ice. So maybe the biggest reason that senior members in families don't want to talk about money in the family is to avoid conflict. It's it's easier sometimes to just let it be a secret and let the heirs deal with it after you're gone. But to get around that, we need to tell family elders that discussion often decreases family tensions rather than exacerbating them. Those tensions might already be there, the suspicions about the will being changed and who's influencing whom and so on. And the light of day can do a lot to put a stop to some of those creeping doubts. Secondly, the misunderstandings that result from poor communication and lack of advanced preparation often damage family relationships, and they can be extremely costly, diminishing family wealth. The elders in a family may not understand or appreciate the desires and talents of other family members, thus producing a plan that doesn't serve the family well. A common example is leaving the business to several children in equal portions, but often one child has dedicated a lot of time and energy to the business, another may not be interested, so equal shares may not do the trick. By talking about money, everybody in the family can get a sense of who's interested in what and design a plan that actually works. Finally, the family elder may not realize how rewarding the fruits of family communication can be in terms of intimacy and or increased family business success while that person is still alive. Another problem that comes up is that the kind of person who builds a family fortune is often at odds with the personality traits of a person who can be supportive and communicative with the family. And what I mean by that is the individuals who are breadwinners often exhibit traits of intense focus or self-absorption, family neglect, control, impatience, a sense of urgency and competitiveness. And they often may not have close ties to the family because they're spending long hours at work. While excelling at personal achievement, these traits can make it difficult for them to nurture or mentor family members. One strategy that sometimes is effective in dealing with these individuals is to appeal to their business dedication, emphasizing that the success of the business may be enhanced now and in the future through effective preparation and grooming of successors, or the success of the family financially in a similar manner. Families with their own businesses also experience communication difficulties as a result of role confusion. In these families, members often wear two hats, a business hat and a family hat. So one story that an advisor told me was that there was a father whose son came to work in the family business after graduating from school, and the son really wasn't doing a very good job. So the father realized he had to do something about it. It was creating a lot of discontent among employees and so on. So when his son showed up for work one Monday morning, the father fired him. But he suggested that they meet tomorrow for lunch. So on Tuesday at lunch, the father met his son at home and had informal clothes. He was relaxed and invited his son to sit down and took on the role as father very clearly and said, "Gee, I heard that your boss fired you yesterday. You know, how do you feel about that? Is there anything I can do to help you?" So the father was saying, "Gee, I'm here to support you, but at the same time, I have to play this other role." And it turned out well that the son actually got his act together and came back to work at the family firm later and became the CEO of the company. So that can help reduce the conflicts and the misunderstandings in families. There are an awful lot of cross currents created by wearing two hats. And finally, sort of related to the conflict avoidance question is the question of tensions and conflicts with problem family members. But again, these can be significantly reduced when estate planning discussions are out in the open and all members are included. It really helps to diffuse someone's frustration and anger and feeling cut off by including them in the discussion. So sometimes it's difficult to start, but after a while, the difficult family member will show up dressed better and behaving better as they begin to feel more listened to and a part of things. The chances for misunderstandings down the road are also greatly limited because survivors are clear on the actual intent and motives behind the documents, and there's been a buy-in on the part of all concerned. So that's an introduction to the importance of family communication about money, my own story, some of the benefits, and overcoming some of the challenges. Next week in the second part of this show, I'll continue the discussion of the importance of family communication about money, including some tools and techniques useful in starting and maintaining healthy communication, as well as specific resources for learning and assistance.
Bronson Reeves and Foxworth is a fee-based financial planning firm that advises two types of clients, high net worth individuals. What I mean by high net worth varies depending upon the particulars of the situation, but in general I'd say high net worth means net worth exceeding $10 million. Second branch of our practice is corporations hire us to advise their senior executives. The nature of our services involve helping clients identify the appropriate investment strategy, the appropriate income tax and estate planning strategies, as well as strategies with respect to risk management.
And how long have you been at Bronson?
I've been at Bronson Reeves for about 5.5 years.
And before that you worked at?
I was a tax manager at Arthur Anderson in their private client services group.
Today you're going to talk about different strategies for getting out of concentrated stock positions. So first of all, let me ask you, what would you characterize as a concentrated stock position?
I would characterize a concentrated stock position as any single security position that comprises so much of a client's total investment assets as to warrant some strategy for disposition. In general, if you're looking for a percentage, I'd say that concentrated stock position would be any position that exceeds 20% of a client's total investment assets. Total investment assets are basically the individual's assets less their house or other personal assets.
You consider, when you look at concentrated stock position, do you consider options as well? Options that are unvested, options that are vested, options that are vested but not purchased?
Yeah, I would say that what a concentrated stock position can consist of is varied. Obviously, it includes single security positions, shares of stock. It can also include option grants in stock, employee stock purchase plan, shares purchased inside a retirement plan.
How is it typically that people end up with concentrated stock positions?
I would say that concentrated stock positions can arise for a number of reasons. The most common example is somebody acquires concentrated stock positions through their employment with the company, either through stock purchase plans, restricted stock awards, option grants, employee stock purchase plan participation, or retirement plans where company stock is acquired. There are other ways of acquiring single security positions, which include founders of companies or early investors in companies that subsequently go public or get acquired by public companies. They end up with a substantial appreciated stock position. In addition, you can acquire concentrated stock positions through gift or inheritance, or perhaps the lucky few who just by superior investment performance acquire substantial positions.
Your goal then is to diversify the portfolio.
Depends on the context from which the client arrives at our door. If they arrive at our door with a concentrated stock position, that is usually the reason they've come to us. to
right.
manage that, the disposition of that position. But there are other considerations in evaluating whether the concentrated stock position is the primary issue to address or a secondary issue. For example, if Larry Ellison came through the door, perhaps despite the fact that he might have a concentrated stock position, it perhaps isn't the first order of business to attend to,
sure.
Under the assumption that he has a substantial amount of assets outside Oracle.
People who have accumulated concentrated positions are most likely very good business people or very good investors. They must know the value of diversity, yet many have had difficulty or reluctance to disposition of the concentrated position. What holds these people back from doing what they know they should do?
For them not doing so, I think, are primarily behavioral or psychological issues. First issue probably being the idea that they think the company has good opportunities in the future and they don't want to miss the potential stock rise that comes subsequent to their sale. I think the other possibility is that people that generate concentrated stock positions, if I can generalize here, are people that are normally driven and are risk takers. And they recognize the risks of what they're taking on and they believe in a rational fashion that it makes sense. They perhaps don't understand the true risk that they're taking on in any quantifiable measure, and that's something we can educate clients on.
Imagine that some of our listeners might identify with that, that they have concentrated stock positions and they realize that they haven't sought help for it, but they realize that they probably should. How should they begin to think about it, begin to address those behavioral issues?
Yeah, I think the critical element to identify is the client's objectives, particularly with reference to their view of financial security, and that's a term I'll probably use a lot in this interview, so let me define it. When I use the term financial security, I mean a financial position that is sufficient enough to maintain the individual's lifestyle for the balance of their life without reliance on any other professional income. So financial security is something we all strive to achieve, or at least most of us, and once we've achieved it, what it means is that you don't have to work anymore, and you can maintain your lifestyle for the balance of your life without having to work anymore. You can understand now how a concentrated stock position that moves somebody above the line to financial security is an enormous accomplishment, an enviable position, but it is also precarious in that the maintenance of that level of financial security is largely determined by the stock price of the concentrated position. When one recognizes that there's really a trade-off there inherent in this position, holding this position, which is locking up financial security or risking it risking financial security in the hopes of gaining additional assets that on the margin may not be as important to the client, is something that needs to be addressed. And that's usually where we start, making sure we understand the client's objectives, making sure we understand the nature of the concentrated stock position. Once you understand the client's primary objectives and the nature of the concentrated stock position, the answer, the solution, falls out pretty easily.
Once a person has decided to seek a disposition strategy, what are the options you have to choose from?
There are really three general categories. One is basically sell either immediately or through some periodic sale plan. Two is to hedge the position using derivatives and deferring the sale until some future period of time. The third alternative is a kind of a failed transaction with perhaps some different tax consequences, which we can talk about a little more in detail.
Okay. So let's go over each of those three in order then. First of all, selling. It's interesting you bring that up because a lot of people don't think of that as an option. Sometimes people look for the more complicated solution when the simpler solution might suit them.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I think what scares off a lot of people are the tax liabilities associated with disposition of shares. I would just point out that the capital gains rates are very low by historical standards, and this is not such a bad time to take the money and run because the tax cost of selling is probably lower, as low as it will ever be. In the selling category, I would say there's two primary options here. One is just an outright sale. However, some people cannot avail themselves of that because they are executives or insiders or holders a material percentage of the stock and are limited in some fashion to what they can sell on the open market. If the company provides for this, sell through what's called a 10b5-1 plan, which is a SEC-provided program sale technique that allows an individual some protection against insider trading rules. It's not an absolute protection against those kind of risks, but it does allow an individual to sell on a program basis even inside closed window periods.
And the 10b5-1 simplistically is where you would make a decision beforehand on how much of a holding you're going to sell and at what periodic rate prior to any knowledge of what may happen.
That's right. You generally have to submit your 10b5-1 sale program at least 90 days before you actually start selling. You must do so by informing the company of your plan. It can involve both stock and options, and it must specify what prices, how many shares, and at what price you are directing sales. There's some flexibility in how you can work that. It doesn't have to be a straight market price. You can sell based on, you know, limit orders or something like that.
So sales options are oftentimes the most appropriate solution. The second solution you mentioned are hedging solutions. Let's talk about those.
Hedging, I think, has gotten a lot of press. It was very popular during the dot-com boom. It involves several different derivative components or combinations of derivatives. The first one, most simplistic, is protecting your downside by buying put options, which is basically buying the right to sell a stock at a certain price. So that protects you on the downside to some extent. And it costs money to pay for that put option premium. Second type of hedge is a zero premium collar, where you buy that perhaps same or a modified put option, but instead of using your own money to pay for the premium, you sell call options on the other side that generate enough premium to cover the cost of the put. So that's why it's called a zero premium collar. The individual pays no net premium, and what you really have is you've banded your exposure to an individual stock.
Let's put some numbers that to give an illustration. If a stock is worth today $10, for instance, you could have a put at $8 and a call at $12. Sell the call, buy the put, and in theory for the same amount, you'd buy a put for $2 and sell a call for $2. And so that's why it would be a $0 transaction.
In actual fact, you don't always get such symmetry around the current stock price, but you may end up being able to acquire 100% downside risk, meaning that your put protects you against any reduction in the price, and it may cost you a great deal more of the upside, or alternatively, cost you a lot more of your upside to get greater downside protection. Another way of hedging, and those prior to were not really diversifying strategies, all they did was protect your exposure to stock price movements in the concentrated stock position that you have. There are ways to also get some dollars out of a hedge that will allow you to diversify your position. And the first of those is you take that zero premium collar and you also borrow money from on that contract. And then you can use that borrowed money to invest in a diversified portfolio of assets. Similar to that is a variable prepaid forward contract where the financing is in fact embedded within the collar itself, and the result is essentially the same.
And so you're effectively taking a concentrated stock position there. You're saying it can only get so low and it can only get so high, so you're sort of protecting that. And then you're taking the money from that and borrowing money.
You might be able to borrow out of the contract up to 90% of the position.
Using prepaid variable forwards has some tax advantages and security built in. Why else would someone choose to use this method?
Yeah, there are two reasons. One is that the taxable event will not occur until the termination of the prepaid forward contract, which is typically 2 or 3 years. It can be any number of years. It can't be shorter, I think, than 2 years. So one reason is to defer the taxes, as you said. The other reason is because the individual is somewhat bullish on the stock. You'll notice that embedded in this zero premium collar that there is still some upside participation. If the band is 80-120, like you described earlier, then that first 20% of appreciation the investor will participate in. And if the individual thinks that the stock is going to go up from here, that is a way to participate in some element of the appreciation. So those are the two reasons, I think, why a prepaid forward contract makes sense.
The final method you mentioned for disposition was a sale without a tax consequence. Can you tell us more about that option?
Yeah, there's really two common strategies here. The first is called an exchange fund. And exchange funds are created by various investment houses to provide a diversification technique without tax consequences. And they do so under rules that are very complicated, and I'm not sure I understand completely. But they set up a partnership, basically. Individuals contribute their concentrated single security positions, each of which is risky on their own, but when blended in a certain fashion that the exchange fund pays considerable attention to maintain, looks very close to an index kind of a fund. If you meet certain IRS rules, contribution of these positions does not create a taxable event. In general, contributing assets to a partnership does not create tax. So one converts a concentrated single security position into a partnership interest that is in fact invested in a whole portfolio of other concentrated stock positions on the part of the other contributors. And the end result is you exchange your concentrated stock position for a diversified portfolio. Providing that you hold on to that position for at least 7 years, you can later extract yourself from that partnership and receive as a distribution of your partnership interest a representative sample of the portfolio, which means that you will, instead of, you'll have gotten rid of your one single security stock and receive a whole portfolio of stocks. Now your tax basis in the portfolio is still low, so if you dispose of any of those stocks, you will pay tax. But say if your goal was to diversify your position, you've done so without tax consequence. The second common diversification strategy is the use of charitable remainder trusts, and there are many types of charitable remainder trusts, and they're quite complicated, nuanced vehicles. But in general, what they provide is a fixed percentage of the trust's value to the contributor for some period of time. The advantages of the charitable remainder trusts are tax exempt, so once the single security position is contributed to the charitable remainder trust, the charitable remainder trust can sell that position and not pay any taxes currently. There are two bad things. One is that as the charitable remainder trust makes distributions to the individual, those distributions will be subject to tax based upon an ordering rule that may create ordinary or capital gain income. But the second bad thing is that, or not necessarily a bad thing, but negative economic consequence to the contributor, is that the remainder of these trust assets at the expiration of the term, which is usually based on a period of years or the life or lives of the people that contribute the assets, goes to charity. So there is a significant, must be, under the IRS rules, a significant component going to charity out of this thing, and that reduces the economics to some extent. But if the individual is young enough, healthy enough, lucky enough to survive for many years receiving this distribution, it can in fact pencil out to be a much better result than an outright sale, paying the tax, and investing the after-tax proceeds.
And I imagine that it also attracts people who are passionate about a charity.
Absolutely.
And want to.
Absolutely. If a charitable intent on establishing a charitable remainder trust helps a great deal, it is not surprisingly not a critical component because despite the charitable component of this, charitable remainder trusts can still make great economic sense under the right set of circumstances, regardless of the charitable provision.
Okay. Getting back to the exchange fund that you were talking about, some of our listeners might think of it almost as a mutual fund where you're pooling resources together in exchange for a share of a completely diversified portfolio. The main difference besides the taxation structure being that when you want to come out, you don't sell your share, you get your proportionate amount of each of the shares of stock.
I think there is some analogy to a mutual fund. However, there are some significant disadvantages compared to a mutual fund. The disadvantages are the 7-year lockup has considerable implications to the liquidity. Now, you can pull the plug and get out, but getting out basically just accelerates the taxes because what you'll get out is not a portfolio of securities, but you'll either get your own stock back or something else the exchange fund would like to get rid of. And if the exchange fund would like to get rid of it, I strongly suggest that the individual taking the distribution also move quickly to get rid of it, which means you're not deferring the taxes. The second setback is these exchange funds have much higher annual expenses than does the typical index fund, which they're intended to replicate. Now, obviously, there's good reasons for the fees to be higher. Setting these things up is not simplistic, but there's a considerable drag. If I had my choice, I would much prefer a low-cost mutual fund to an exchange fund, but you cannot avoid or defer the taxes with a mutual fund option. The ones I have seen track and had my clients invest in do, in fact, move very closely to the S&P 500, which was the benchmark they were trying to duplicate. There is a certain component of the exchange fund must be in something other than marketable securities, and so there is tends to be some divergence between the exchange fund performance and the S&P 500. But in my experience, it's been relatively minor, and it has been risk-reducing in that in down markets, the exchange funds have performed slightly better, and in up markets, they've performed not quite as well.
What would be the other component?
Real estate. Investments of some kind.
So knowing this now, maybe we can talk about, depending on a client's goals, which of these fit better. So we've got selling outright. We've got hedging, which we talked about, variable prepaid forwards, puts, costless collars. And then we talked about sale without tax consequence, which had exchange fund and general manager trust.
Yeah, the first issue is, you know, if this single security position has put an individual into a situation of financial security, and that would be the case even if the stock, the single security position, were sold and the taxes paid, one would be hard-pressed to argue with anything more complicated than an outright sale. However, there are many instances where owners of highly appreciated stock and concentrated stock positions cannot sell for one reason or the other, because they are subject to SEC regulations, because they are subject to company restrictions, because they are perhaps limited by what the market conditions are, or political considerations in that if they sell, their bosses won't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are all very complicated issues and highly technical. The reasons why you don't sell with respect to at least the SEC rules, and those are technical. They impose upon their government-imposed rules on the or limitations on the individual's ability to dispose of a single security position, and you need to follow them.
Mm-hmm.
And they are complicated and hard to understand, and I suggest that one start with their company counsel as a good beginning point. Just in general, these things can put volume limitations or time limit, holding limit, period limitations on one's ability to sell. Section 16, this short swing profit rule, is particularly onerous in that if a person subject to this Section 16, which basically means executives and officers and other interested parties with greater than 10% ownership, were to buy and sell the security within a 6-month period, any profits from that transaction, from those combined transactions, would have to be disgorged, and that's extremely punishing. So there are these SEC rules. There are also the company restrictions, company-imposed restrictions, such as having windows closed, having underwriter lockups that prohibit somebody from selling their positions. If you are exposed to these kind of limitations, you have to do something else. Now, it may be that if you can't sell, you may also not be able to hedge. And so more creative solutions are necessary. In one case, we actually suggested the client quit so they stopped being an affiliate so that they could sell their position in the open market.
That's interesting when you talk about hedging and not, maybe not being able to hedge. One thing that I wanted to mention when we're talking about tax consequences is we've been talking about long-term capital gains. And I know that one of the reasons people will sometimes hold on to a concentrated stock position is to get the long-term capital gain instead of a short-term gain, what would be taxed as ordinary income.
Yes, well, that really gets to the issue. I mean, rarely it can happen that a stock will appreciate so fast that one will achieve enormous appreciation within a one-year period and be faced with the issue of selling the position and paying short-term capital gains. More often, that occurs in the context of incentive stock options, where if the individual exercises the option and holds the stock for a year, they can achieve long-term capital gain taxation on the appreciation between the stock strike price, the purchase price, and the current value at the time of at the sales price at the time of date of the sale. Now, this is a very complicated issue and one fraught with landmines. The idea of accepting single security concentration for a year in order to save a 15%, in order to be taxed at 15% as opposed to the 38 or whatever percent tax, 35.6 I believe now, federal tax rate, is something somebody should think very carefully about. the amount of risk one takes by holding that single security for that period of time, and when you consider the other tax potential tax ramifications, which could involve the being subject to the alternative minimum tax, you could imagine a disastrous scenario where the option is exercised when the stock is at a high price, subjecting the individual to alternative minimum tax in the year of exercise. The stock price collapses, and the individual sells the stock at substantially less than the taxes they actually had to pay upon its exercise.
And living in the Silicon Valley, we've heard those horror stories, plenty of those horror stories.
Yes, I think chasing tax savings or trying to make the economic decision about single security risk reduction based on a desire to save taxes is oftentimes unwarranted.
And a person cannot, if a person does have ISOs instead of stock options and they're trying to save this tax, hedging is not an option.
Generally, that's true. If you're not restricted by the company's guidelines in your ability to hedge, an individual can hedge their position even if it's in the form of options.
However, from a tax standpoint, when you hedge and freezes the time, even if you do a put, if you hold for a year and then sell, it's not considered a long-term.
Correct.
Yeah. To summarize, we've talked about what makes a concentrated stock position. Very simplistically, 20% of investable assets in a single stock would be considered concentrated. We talked about how a person may acquire a concentrated stock position, typically through an executive compensation package or inheritance. We've talked about the value of diversification and why someone should diversify. We talked about the opportunities for the disposition of the concentrated stock position, primarily selling, hedging, or sales without a tax consequence. And we covered, in general terms, when each of those strategies would make sense for what type of client.
Yes, I would just close by saying that if you are in the enviable position of having a highly concentrated stock position, and that concentrated stock position is of a magnitude to allow you to realize financial security, seriously consider some strategy for disposition to make sure that that financial security is retained without regard to movements in the underlying position.
And needless to say, we stress in every show that when you're faced with these situations, make sure to consult a professional.
Don't try this at home.
So thanks a lot, Skip. We really appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you.
Wow, great information on this week's show. Remember, holding a large portion of your wealth in one single investment is very risky, whether it be stocks, bonds, real estates, or any other investment. Thanks again to Peter for introducing the topic of family communication in estate planning. Please join us next week for the second part when Peter talks about tools and techniques for proper family wealth planning and communication. Once again, if you haven't visited our website, please go to www.promoneytalk.com. There you can ask questions and sign up for our email list. Once again, I'm Jason for Peter. Thanks for listening.